So where we left off, chapter 8 is running a bit long, but we'll pick up. It's just that there's quite a bit of content in there. So I just wanted to move through it proportionally so that we cover the important items that are in there, because just like chapter 7, the Bread of Life discussions, sometimes John takes the time out to get into the dialogue between the Pharisees and then Jesus. And Jesus is making now his theological statements. And clearly we can see from what we saw in chapter 7, plus what we're seeing here in chapter 8, why John's gospel is considered for the Orthodox faith and for the Catholic faith too, that it is really the centerpiece of the basis for our Christian theology. All right. So we left off at verse 32. And I'm
That's
just
the only one of the four that's really intended for already believers, right? The other three are evangelizing.
correct. And also remember that part of John's mission was to overcome and provide information to help early Christians combat the heresies that were coming up. And at that time, it was definitely Docetism, and it was Arianism and Gnosticism. So, and those all came from very reasonable places. Why is Jesus Christ any different from any other prophet? And how is he foretold? Why was he different from the major and the minor prophets that we've already had? Some of the Jews definitely thought that we were overreaching with some of our theologies into the Old Testament. And to some extent that is true, because we've seen over the years that certain theologians and people have overreached themselves going back into the Old Testament and trying to make everything that is there bend or fit into a prefigurement of Christ. Clearly, there was, for us as Christians, there was a great deal of prefigurement, but sometimes we have had a tendency to go overboard and make everything now a prefigurement. In fact, one of the Sunday school videos that's going to be coming up, when we talk about Samson, we're actually going to talk about that idea of being able to discern when too much is when too much is too much. All right. So what I'm going to do here is when I'm going to start off with everybody's got their Bible here. I'm going to start off with Ethel, and I'm going to ask her if you would take us from third verse 31 to 33. Chapter 8, obviously.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?"
Okay, so in the beginning, in the beginning verse that she read, which was 31, which we kind of left off yesterday, okay, we said that John ends the dialogue from the preceding part, saying that to the Jews who believed in him, and if we put a new share up here, hold up. And I know those words, let me just make them a little bit bigger here. Okay. And so I've got the NIV version here, and it looks like that's pretty much what you read. So here, as excuse me, as Ethel read, to the Jews who believed him, and Jesus said, "If you hold to my teachings, then you are my disciples." So he's giving us a command And he's also giving us an instruction. He's saying now, if you hold, okay, what is it that makes you my disciples? All right. So one part is faith, but the other part then is that you actually now, you keep these teachings. So, this is kind of funny what we'll see in church many times is that you'll see people come to church. And I remember I had to shadow a priest when I was at the seminary. And so I would follow, and he was my old Testament professor. And so I'd follow him to this one church, and he would bring out just this point, because he'd say, watch these people during the church service and watch how they behave. And they behave very well, and they all were attentive and everything like that. And coffee hour was very nice. And then we would go out and we would leave. We would go out into the parking lot, and they'd be yelling at one another, and a couple of them would be cursing at one another. So do they believe? We would have said, yes, they believe. But if what is true belief means that you actually have to, that the teachings, you have to hold to these teachings, not only when you are in church, but that it becomes a lifestyle. And this is certainly what we say about Orthodoxy, is that Orthodoxy is not so much a faith as it is a way of life. Okay. And that is the truth that sets you free. All right.
I sure hope God gives us credit for trying.
And yes. and I hope so too. But I'm confident in that, because throughout the Gospels, we have many, many times where we see people who have fallen short, quote unquote, to the glory of God, and they have been accepted in the kingdom of heaven. And in fact, I think it was just last week that we were talking about the thief on the cross, you know, who really wasn't demonstrating in his life Christian principles, but through his truthful repentance, then he was granted then that kingdom. Maybe not on that exact day. We don't know about that. So, all right. So here, as she said, and then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So John's repeated use of the verb ginosko, okay, to know, together with pistevo, obviously to believe, right, is meant that to emphasize the important relationship between these words, all right, that belief will lead to knowledge. This is where we had the problem with Gnosticism, because Gnosticism now comes from that ancient Greek philosophical idea that Aristotle had, that Plato had, that Socrates had, is this what knowledge is the ability to think about God. So for John, gnosis is not understood in the classic Greek sense of theorin, okay, and I think we talked a little bit about that last week, this idea of contemplating God. Greek philosophy saw man's change, his attitude towards the divine, that when you have the knowledge of God, then that's when you can, quote unquote, see or auro God. And this concept is evident, you know, in the root of theorin. So for the Greeks and for philosophy, contemplation of God is the way that in which man seeks to be like the immortals. Okay. Now, this is not exactly theosis, okay, for the Orthodox, okay, because there has to be an experience here. And for the Greeks, it was more about knowledge and about contemplation. So it's not exactly, it's similar, all right? And the divine is revealed in this contemplation. And now the Gnostics took that idea on. But the problem with that is that then knowledge of God becomes an object which can be possessed. And if we go into the, and if we look into the Old Testament, what was, or is, I should say, what did God tell Moses his name was?
I am that I am.
I am that I am. So and the idea, at least for us as Orthodox, is that we don't see faith as a possession, meaning that we thought about God, therefore we know God, and now he becomes that object of contemplation, which can be possessed, and then that reveals his divine truth. Christianity rejects this idea, asserting that truth can only be seen through our faith. Okay, so, and going back to Farley's words there in the book that we're using for this Bible study, or one of the books we're using, that study of the law cannot affect or create or give us then that inner transformation. As our bishop likes to say, come to the liturgy, but leave transformed. So and I like that because it invokes this idea of participation. So in this way, Orthodoxy is not dogmatically focused on thinking about God. Not that we're dumb. I mean, we certainly do have, you know, through St. Gregory, St. John Chrysostom, St. Simeon the New Theologian, we certainly have very detailed theological ideas, but without an actual practical exercise in faith, then we cannot know or see, if we use that term, see God. All right. So Orthodox worship in its fullness demands experiential participation, not only with the mind, hearing the gospel, but also worship, which is our liturgy, and then a physicality that we obey, that we remain in Christ. And that's through the actual taking in of Holy Communion and receiving him physically. So for Orthodox, it's all three. We have to hear the gospel. We have to go, we need worship. We worship who God is, but then we listen to Christ and we actually take him in. So for Orthodoxy, this is what distinguishes eternal life from the temporal worldly life, which only now leads to death. This is one of the issues that we have with, let's say, I don't want to say high Protestantism, but sometimes with lower Protestantism, non-denominational churches, is that the focus becomes so much on just the hearing, which is the gospel, that the worship part becomes the worship of the book. And we want to be careful that we are the worshiper of the word, not the book. Commentary on that, or that?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on that, but we don't have.
All right. So
mostly pertaining to the shortcoming of Protestantism as a theology, but you know.
Yeah, and this is and certainly one of the strengths that Protestantism brings to the table of Christianity, that sometimes Orthodoxy is not that good at, is an absolute willingness to evangelize at all times. There is a real fervor there to evangelize, you know. I mean, even, and again, Orthodoxy will laugh at it a little bit when people come up and, do you know Jesus? And this is the kind of fervor that that I think that we would benefit from. So there, certainly we would benefit from a much more, I think, in terms of setting out who we are, a much more disciplined approach, which Catholicism brings. Now, sometimes, but they go overboard and it becomes too dogmatic. So we don't want that. But at the same time, we're called to evangelize. This is what we hear at the baptismal reading every time. So there are certainly things to be gleaned from Catholicism, Protestantism, So we don't want to be prideful that, you know, we, you know, we say we are the possessors of the possessors of truth. And, you know, we are the fullness of the faith without a doubt. But sometimes we don't do a good job of exercising that that fullness. So.
Father, could that be because just growing up Greek Orthodox, we're just baptized, we're told we're Greek Orthodox, and then it kind of just ends with that? And we just walk around knowing that we're Greek Orthodox. We don't, contemplate saying, well, maybe I'll just speak for myself, you know, oh, should I be Protestant or something else, I guess? I don't know if I'm saying it right.
No, you're right. I mean, we do, and certainly I recognize that, or have recognized that in myself, that those of us who are what we would call cradle Orthodox, you know, do tend to take the faith for granted. And sometimes I think we are not so motivated to talk about the faith because we may not know our faith as well as, let's say, a Protestant knows his or her faith.
Margie LaRusa, Buffalo Annunciation, or Margie LaRusa.
Oh, sorry about that.
Oh, okay, that was you. I thought I was doing something wrong.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. Other devices are connected to this.
gotcha.
Sorry, folks.
So like I said, so, and Jack, brings up a good point. Certainly there are failings that the Orthodox would say from the Protestant faith, and failings within the Catholic faith, but we have to also recognize without a vainglorious attitude, what some of our issues are, and then work to make sure that we are the expression of the fullness of the faith. Orthodoxy is, but we also want to we want to be that, the physically be that fullness. All right, so
I think it's
go ahead.
I think it's rather fun. It's interesting that you say that one thing we could learn to emulate from Protestants is the evangelical attitude. And I find that interesting because one of my questions early on to you during the Q&As was, you know, how we should witness to somebody who's been hurt by the church. And you were just saying that, well, we shouldn't be witnessing. And I'm like, interesting.
And maybe
I would have to retread all of that. I'm probably misunderstanding somewhere.
That's why I have Terry as the host, because she can correct my forays into heresy. So that's been really good. but no, we do have an evangelical aspect. However, sometimes to be evangelical also means to be a silent witness. Sometimes we don't have to say anything. Our actions will speak rather than just our words. So that's kind of where more of how I meant that.
I'm reminded of one of the memes making the rounds.
No.
Just saying, how should we advertise we're Christian? You want to put something on the letterhead? You want to put little crosses on the envelopes? How? And you know, Jesus, the boss, says maybe they could know us by how we treat our customers and how we love and so forth.
True. Mark, I am going to have you now take us through verse 33 down to 35.
I don't have my, can you give me a moment, or I don't know if somebody else has it ready to go. I'm on my phone, so I need to pull it up on the.
All right.
Do you want me to read it until yep. Mark can get his phone up and running?
Yep. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put it up here so that people can kind of read along. All right. So 33 to 35, Nikki.
Okay. 33 to 35.
Correct.
So I'm in the Orthodox Study Bible. I don't know. Good. If that's a little different. They answered him, quote, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" Where I think in the other one it said, "We will be made free."
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly," or quote, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the son makes you free, you shall be free indeed.
Okay. So if we take a look at verse 34, all right. And right here, right, we see John's use of the amin amin. We see that, right? And we know that we've seen this many times in the text. So this is a literary device that tells us what? The double amin tells us what?
For sure.
Keep going with that thought.
Okay, hold on. I got to go back and read up.
But
so,
and it doesn't, and we don't have to tie it to anything particular here. But when you hear Jesus say, "Amin, amin, lewe min," or "Truly, truly, I say to you," then the gospel writer is telling us are these are important facts. So right. What comes after this is very critical to our salvation. Okay. And that's clearly what we can see in here. But let's start now with back to verse 33. All right.
Because I can't read Greek, can you read it in Greek so I can see what the actual words sound like in Greek to compare them to the English? Because sometimes I feel that translation gets me a little confused.
For you're saying verse 34 there?
I'm just saying any of it, like, you know, when you're hearing the gospel and you're reading it in Greek and then it's read in English.
Right.
Then you're thinking of all the words and the sayings. And sometimes that translation just kind of gets lost, or it's just me not, you know.
Right. Right. And that's, and.
Do you know what I'm saying?
That's what I try to do in the Bible study. In fact, we're going to see this here in a little bit, but that's why I think that the Bible study is important, because sometimes you don't have the time during the liturgy to actually talk about some of those key points that come out in Greek. So now let me get back to the study guide here. All right. So in verse 33, okay, is one of the most, and quoting now, one of the most profound of the Johannine misunderstandings, as it speaks of a misunderstanding both from a Jewish and a philosophical sense. Now, we've already seen some of the philosophical issues that we've seen, that this philosophical idea, which has been present in the Greeks of that time, is that to contemplate God is to know God. So faith comes through knowledge, all right? For the Jews now, remember, the Jews interpret things in a Midrash type of idea, where they look for the practical applications. And so they don't have really, the Jews at that time do not really look at it from a metaphysical standpoint and look at what are those spiritual aspects. So there's two misunderstandings here that John is bringing forward to us. For the Jews, they see freedom as a physical freedom that we would see in the classic idea of slavery. And that freedom was granted by God by sending his prophet Moses, who now released them from their bondage. All right. So the Jews see his statement as from a worldly perspective in there, and I said Midrashic interpretation, because Midrash, remember, means that they're taking this literally. How does this apply to life here on earth? So they see now Jesus's promise of setting them free as an insult, because Moses already set us free. And now you're telling me that you've come now and you're going to set us free? We have, and so their answer to them is, we have always been the descendants, teknon, of Abraham, and that through us as being the chosen people, we have never been slaves to anyone, which obviously is untrue, because as we know through their bondage for 400 years in Egypt, and then after that, their bondage under many of the kingdoms like the Midianites and the Persians and the Babylonians who enslaved them, we know that that's not necessarily the case. So the question is, how can you say that we're going to be set free? So we already talked about the philosophical standpoint, all right? So, but freedom now, Jesus is showing the divine aspect. And this is now where that's why this statement of Amin, Amin is so important, is because what Jesus is talking about is a spiritual bondage that we all encounter. And now we have to kind of think back. Remember this whole discussion about you will die in your sins, okay? And he says, you are trapped by sin and you will die in your sins, the singular versus the plural. So he's reiterating that point here, talking about, in truth I tell you, I mean, everyone who commits sin now becomes a slave to that sin and becomes separated from God. So Jesus now offering from the Father salvation is liberation from the slavery of sin, and liberating them are us from death and from an existence that is separate from God. For the gospel writer, true freedom is recognition of who is the person of Jesus as the ultimate redeemer sent by God to humanity to redeem those who remain in him and are his disciples. As we saw earlier, right? If you hold to my teachings, all right, those who remain in him. And as I mentioned in the last Bible study, this is why Holy Communion is considered salvific for Orthodox, is because there is a literal remaining in him, which is to take him in as the body and blood through the bread and the wine. Okay. So in verse 834, in truth, I tell you, everyone who commits, okay, the truth will set you free. So there is a slavery from which Adam's descendants were not exempt and which Abraham cannot affect. We're going to see in this discussion as it continues that they are placing all of their pride and their hope in the patriarch of Abraham, that Abraham was reckoned as righteous before God and that he will be made the father of many nations. And we as the Jews are the product, we're the technon of that generation. And Jesus is going to make a separation here. All right. We're going to see that. Unlike external slavery, for which Moses was a redeemer, this more metaphysical slavery or bondage to sin, and that's why the way that Nikki read that, those who are in bondage to sin, is rooted in what is our personal relationship with God. And how is it that we view our relationship to God? If we view it as an obligation, and this is why the Orthodox do not like the term that the Catholics use, you'll hear Catholics say, does this meet my obligation? We don't have that language, because obligation doesn't imply a personal relationship. An obligation is what a slave has. And Jesus tells us later, I do not call you, you are not slaves. I call you friends. So in that sense, we do more agree with the Protestants is when they say, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? So we more align with that than we do with the statement of obligation that you have met. All right. Notice again the singular form of the word sin. All right. So in truth, I tell you, everyone who commits sin is a slave. So now we're back to the singular again. And Jesus, as here before, is not speaking of sin in terms of sins of passion, but as a persistent human willfulness and an attitude of hostility towards God, the one who tells the truth, from which he has heard from God the Father. Okay. And where do we see, or what are some examples that we've seen from the gospel in terms of persistence of human willfulness?
Well, the entire book of Jeremiah.
Keep going.
I'm doing a 1 year Bible study and around Jeremiah right now, and we're halfway through the book, and every single chapter is the Lord told Jeremiah to tell the Israelites to do this, and the Israelites said no, and the Lord said, "Fine, I'm going to ruin you all," and that's every single chapter of Jeremiah.
So that's great. Mine was Hosea. I was thinking of Hosea because I love the opening line of that he tells Hosea, "I want you to go and marry a prostitute, and I want you to have a child with this prostitute." He says, "Because Israel has turned their back on me, and they now have prostituted themselves to idolatry." So this is a willfulness on their part. So we've seen examples of this before. And it just seems to be a human trend. We've probably all known people that when we ask them, about church and would you like to become part of our church and be part of our community, sometimes the answers that we hear is, "Nah, I'm good," or "I don't really need to go. I don't see the purpose of it. I'm spiritual." So these are all willing rejections now of having this personal relationship. Our personal relationship as Orthodox would be that life that we have in our community. Coming to Sunday worship, but also being active in the life of the church. All right. So that's why I like to say, just because you have your seat, just because you're sitting in church, does not necessarily have you holding to the teachings of Christ. This is a dramatic pause just to make sure that everybody is still with me there, or a commentary. All right.
I was also thinking about how it's like, it's all throughout the Old Testament, but we just go on, this is exactly what Jesus is accusing them of right now. It's like, "I'm trying to tell you what's going on, but you keep rejecting me because your father is the devil."
Oh, right. And we're certainly going to get to that. In Judaism, the idea of becoming a slave to sin is a very real concept. And we see this in Genesis. All right. If I go back to and we're I think most of us, if not all of us, are familiar with the Cain and Abel story. Okay. And it says, so we have now the Lord speaking to Cain and saying, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted?" All right. And so he's speaking directly to us now also, saying, don't, when something happens to you, but you know that you are in the right, okay, then don't be angry, don't be downcast. Why? Because if you choose the path that is not right, and the word in this idea of sin is crouching at your door, the Hebrew here, and my Old Testament professor was very well versed in Hebrew, so he would say that we have to look at this word crouching in a very animalistic sense, meaning like a lion or a beast of prey would crouch down waiting, okay? And this desires to have you is more devour you is So the strength of the Hebrew here is not brought out necessarily to its fullest extent. So here we have in Genesis, the Jews knowing what is the damaging effect of sin is that one, it seeks you out like a wild animal, and it seeks to devour you, but through belief and through knowing who God the Father is, okay, and now we would say in a Trinitarian sense, who now Christ is, that we have the strength now that we can overcome it, that we can become its master. And this is really at the core of what we see in Orthodox monasticism. And when you read St. John Climacus and you read St. Anthony and you read St. Gregory and you read their instructions, they always use that language of Genesis, where they speak of the fact that passions crouch at your door, and those passions can overtake and devour you, but through belief in knowing and faith in knowing who the Trinitarian God is that's what gives us then the strength to rule over it. So the same idea that Orthodoxy has, this is its source coming then from here in all the way back in Genesis. That's why I wanted to bring that one up. Okay, 8:35. Nikki also read. Now a slave has no, and again, I'm reading from the New Jerusalem Bible, so it may be a little bit different. Now a slave has no permanent standing in the household, but a son belongs to it forever. All right. So Jesus now shifts from now this idea of the slave to sin and uses the imagery of actual slavery of that time, okay? In a parable easily recognizable to the people of Jesus' time as well. The slave does not have a permanent home, thus this idea of does not abide in the house forever, meaning that he can be taken and sold at any time. But that who I call family, in this case, he uses son, okay? That person has a right of inheritance. And now he says, I call you friend. Later on, he talks to the apostles in that manner. So those now who are part of the family, who are technon Isus, those now can claim an inheritance or a right from the master of the house, assuming that they abide in what is the master's idea, okay, and that they are granted that inheritance right forever, all right. And so Jesus now takes that meaning, just like he does in many parables and many metaphors, and he brings that back to what it means physically at that moment. The shift is made back to Jesus as the son, the only son, and the house that you abide in forever then is the kingdom of heaven. So just as he does in previous passages, he gives us the metaphor and then he explains the parable to us in actual language. Comments, questions? All right. All right. Now let's take verse 36 to 39, and let's have Mark, you ready?
Yes, I can do that.
All right, so let's you take us from 36 all the way to 39.
Okay.
36 to 38. Sorry, 36 to 38.
Right. Bear with me here. Okay. So if the Son sets you free,
you will be free indeed. I know that you are Abraham's descendants, yet you are looking for a way to kill me because you have no room for my word. I am telling you what I have seen in the Father's presence, and you are doing what you have heard from your father.
All right. Now, and who is he saying is their father? Who is Jesus saying now or accusing them that their father is?
The devil,
exactly right. All right. So that's why I've titled this one Descent from Abraham and then their descent from the devil. So Jesus says to them now, he says, you know, and let me turn back to So here in 37, he says, "Ida oti sperma Abraham este." So either, I know. So not either like see, but either as in, I know that you are. But notice now the difference here, okay? Because he doesn't say deknon like he did before, or what they call themselves, deknon Avram. Notice the word that John is using here is sperma. Okay, so that he's making the distinction here that yes, I know that you are descended from, so that you are the seed of Abraham, but what you are not is you are not the children of Abraham because you don't do what he did, which was honoring and worshiping then the true God through his actions. So he's making the distinction there. All right. I know that you are Abraham's descendants. Yet here you are looking for a way to kill me. That shows that they are not Abraham's children because they're not behaving the way that in just as you saw in the previous, that behaving as a son who would inherit now this righteousness and this freedom that Abraham had. All right. So you're looking for a way to kill me. All right. Let's go back. So Jesus acknowledges the point, like we said, okay, for they are trapped in their human darkness and do not comprehend the true meaning of who Jesus is from a salvific perspective, all right? As did Abraham, because, and this is going to be the difference in John versus the other gospel writers, is who is Abraham? So Abraham is seen by the Jews as the patriarch. He is now who we gain our freedom from. For John, Abraham is the prototype of faith, and he is the father of belief. So there's a difference, and here's the disconnect between how the Jews are viewing Abraham and who he is versus now how the Christian views who Abraham is. Abraham for us is a patriarch. And historically, that's who he is. But who he is for us spiritually is he is the prototype of righteousness, and he is the father of belief. And that's what's important here to John to pass on to his Christian audience. The evidence of the fact that they are trapped in their human darkness is Jesus' next statement. So I know that you are descended from Abraham, but you're not his children. Why? Because you look for to kill me. And you don't act or you don't remain in me. You are not part of me, or else you wouldn't now be looking to murder me or to kill me. The Jews now add to their previous claim of being Abraham's descendants by saying that Abraham is also their father, claiming to follow the example he set. All right. But Jesus challenges this and said, and this is where we see now in 38, all right, if you were Abraham's children, then you would do the works. And that's what we have. So Mark, read verse 38 again from yours perspective.
Okay. I am telling you what I have seen in the Father's presence, and you are doing what you have heard from your father.
Okay. So, and so close, because in mine I have, and you too have put into action the lessons you have learned from your father. So in Greek, what we have is that you do the works, da erga tu. Okay, you are doing not the works that Abraham did, but you are doing the works or the actions now of the opposite of what Abraham is. And that's then going to be, obviously, he's accusing them of now listening to their father, Abraham, because I've listened to their father, the devil, because he now, as the prince of lies, is or they are doing exactly what he does. It's interesting because here we have, from these words of Jesus, we also see an echo of St. John the Baptist warnings that we saw both in Matthew and Mark. But when John the Baptist was baptizing, the Pharisees and the Sadducees came to where he was, and John the Baptist accused him and said, "You brood of vipers, produce fruit in keeping with repentance," meaning doing the do the works of Abraham. "And do not think you can say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father." So he makes the same accusation here that Jesus is making, okay? And then he goes on to say what Jesus will say, that the axe is at the root of the trees, and every tree that does not produce good fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire. So we're hearing here in Jesus's words the precursor of what John the Baptist has said. And we call St. John the Baptist the forerunner, because he is saying these same things that now Jesus is saying also. And as I mentioned, this Johannian portrait of Abraham is very different from the picture that's painted by the Jews and by St. Paul. Okay. For St. Paul, in his epistles, Abraham is the great patriarch who was blessed by God for his righteousness, and is the father of many nations and of the Gentiles, who will be then also the future believers. Therefore, the promise comes by faith, by grace, and be guaranteed to Abram's offspring. For John, though, Abraham's importance is that he was the witness coming to Christ. He is the prototype, and he is what gives us the example of how we should be with relation to the Trinitarian God, and how we relate to Jesus, whether we are Jew or whether we are Gentile. Commentary Father, on that.
Father, it's Ethel. It seems to me that the Jewish non-believers and the Pharisees are sort of using as an excuse, "Oh, well, we're children of Abraham. Abraham's our father." And I think at times they sort of, to fit their need, they distort that and its meaning.
Agreed. They're taking the fact that because of what Abraham has done, that they are secure in their salvation. And we see a version of that, you know, in our faith today, you know. And my example to that is, you know, that there are many times, unfortunately, that the baptism is not, and the selection of the godparent is not done with an understanding of what is the importance of the godparent and what is the importance from a salvific standpoint of baptism, but it is something that is done. So just like Ethel, you said, the Jews now rest their belief in the fact that Abraham is their father, the same way that we do. We say, well, as long as we do this thing called baptism, then we're all set. So sometimes we cannot understand, you know, and that lack of understanding is not conducive to our salvation. I don't know if that made sense in terms of my connection there.
Yes, it did. And that was a very good example, because like you said, even in today's world, we see this, where we just find comfort in, you know, baptism. It's an Orthodox, I don't want to say ritual, but it's something that as an Orthodox we follow, but without really understanding the deeper meaning of what it is to be a godparent and to baptize that child.
Right. And the fact that, you know, at least from an Orthodox perspective, that we as godparents are liable for what happens to that child as he or she grows up. So there's a liability that, I hate to put it that way, but there's a liability that we carry from an Orthodox perspective, that if we do not if we do not follow what is our proper role as to be a witness in the life of that child, and we see our salvation as having been completed because we are doing something that our holy fathers did, and if we follow that, like the Jews would follow Abraham, then yes, everything will be okay.
Yes.
So, all right, and then. So it looks like 8:05. We will be, and again, I apologize that we're kind of chapter 8 has taken us so long, but like I said, there is quite a few theological points that are important for us to understand, and so I wanted to spend a bit more time. So let's stop there. We'll certainly pick up then on verse 41, 42, because it is the shift is so interesting here. We haven't gotten down to there yet. Give me one second here.
We didn't cover verse 39 and 40.
So we didn't do 39 to 40. Ah, okay. All right. That's correct. All right. So here in 39, the Jews now repeat, our father is Abraham. So they're making a connection to Abraham. But then if we go down to 41, and we'll spend a little bit of time on this next week. Look, what is the difference now? Look at what they say in verse 39 and look at what they say in verse 41. And what do you see? What's the shift you see there?
There in 41, we have one father, even God. So they're switching from Abraham as our father to basically God as our father.
Right. So this is a very abrupt change, because they've been talking, the dialogue has been about Abraham. Now, all of a sudden in verse 41, they're making the same claim. We're not born illegitimately. Okay. We are the proper seed, but now they talk about they switch to this monotheistic belief. They switch back to, no, we have only one father, and that father is God. So there's an interesting switch or shift there, moving from mm-hmm. Abraham very, very quickly into, no, father, our God is our father. So we'll pick up, like I said, with that when we come back next week. All right.
I like how it says In verse 41, we are not illegitimate children. They protested.
Yes. And clearly, again, this is where this, and John is really pointing this out to us, that there's this disconnect because they can't see past their Midrash interpretation of Jesus's words. And they just can't. And in verse 43, why do you not understand what I say? And the answer to this is because in that Midrashic interpretations, it is the practical application and not the spiritual application. So that blindness of the Pharisees and the Sadducees is now continues to cause the problem, which will ultimately lead them to putting him on the cross. Of course, as we kind of know how the story ends. So
it's a willful blindness then. So it's a willful blindness then, right? Like, so you were talking about willfulness and human willfulness. And so it seems like it's almost something that's sort of an unwillingness, right? Or is that accurate to say? Like a willful blindness?
There's an element of that. There's an element of that unwillingness, but some of that unwillingness comes from their inability to be able to understand that Jesus is sent from God, that he has a divine nature. And so you're right, there is an unwillingness on their part, but part of that comes from the fact that they can't logically get there, right, in their mind, right?
Okay.
So it's not that like, it's sense. Not like they know and they're not right. doing it, right?
Okay. That's,
right.
So. Right, sort of one thing leads to another, sort of, yeah.
Right. And they're very stubborn in and very fixed in that that unwillingness to believe in who Jesus is presenting himself as. And certainly in the end, I mean, as we have at the end of the chapter, once he says, he makes the divinity statement and says, I am, they pick up stones and they throw it at him. So that will be the... That'll be the, they've had it. We're done, you know, so we're just going to have to stone you now. So,
All right.
Well, hey, listen, thanks everybody. I appreciate it. A little bit of a quiet night, but I'm switching a little bit now based on some comments that I've heard and let each one of you read a section or a few passages and maybe that kind of helps to hear the words more than just me speaking about it. So I wanted to make that kind of little small change, and also enjoy kind of, you know, hearing your voice and giving a little bit more room for some feedback and discussion. So